next case on the court's docket is Cody Gettings v. State, number 61849. Mr. Reed, you ready to go?
Yes, sir.
All right.
May it please this honorable court, Norman Reed, Clark County Public Defender's Office, along with Sean Bachman, I'm trial counsel in this matter. With the court's permission, I'd like to start off with the notice issue that was raised in the case. It's Mr. Gettings' position in this case that there was insufficient notice. And if the panel would indulge me for just a minute, I can relay the frustration about not having it be a public record, about not having it been clear about, as a defense lawyer, the struggle that we have to go through when we're not provided with adequate notice. And Mr. Gettings comes to me, what did you get convicted of? Well, you got convicted of second-degree murder by child neglect, felony second-degree murder. Well, based on what facts? Well, I'm not really sure. The tank fell. Cody Gettings was, you shouldn't have gone out into the yard. You weren't attentive to the child. You didn't call 911. You didn't immediately render medical assistance or any combination of that. Because what we know from the charging document is there's not a single word in the charging document that alleges negligence at all, only abuse. And if I could point out also for the justices, there is another critical part to the problem with the pleading in the case. And that is when you look at the count two, count two mentions that there was no sought-out medical aid. In other words, that the allegation is that Mr. Gettings thereafter failed to summon immediate medical assistance. That's mentioned in there twice. This is critical, justices, because this is not an alternative pleading. It's not an and-or. It's a thereafter. So the prosecution's theory was clear. This was abuse, and thereafter, Mr. Gettings didn't immediately seek medical attention. So again, a problem with the pleading that doesn't provide sufficient notice, and the jury recognized it. They did an amazing job, probably better than I did in terms of catching that, because what happens is that they issue a note, and the note says, it's a question too, Justices. Instruction number three, this is on 2716 of the record. Instruction number three, count two. Does count two include in the underlying both action and failure to summon immediately medical assistance, or just fail to immediately summon medical assistance? They recognize the problem. The problem is that they did not find abuse. They found neglect. And the problem is exacerbated by the fact that they recognize in that language thereafter, was that alternative or not? Now, unfortunately, what we have is the typical trial judge's answer, which is just look at the charge and look at the instructions. That's on the second part, 2717 of the record. And that just does not do justice to the notice problem in this case. The jury recognized it. They interpreted that it's obvious as not immediately rendering medical assistance, which could potentially fall into the neglect. Now, the prosecution also mentions the Noonan case. I'm sure the justices are very familiar with Noonan. Noonan does say that there is not, in that case, a requirement that Mr. Noonan had been notified of the theory of felony murder by child neglect. But in the Noonan case, there's two huge differences. Distinction number one is, well, actually there's three. I take that back. Distinction number one is that Mr. Noonan raised the issue of the felony second neglect for the first time when he testified at trial. That is not the case here. Mr. Gettings gave a detailed statement, which is also the subject of this panel's review, outlining that the tank had fallen on Addison Weiss, the deceased child. Throughout, from the beginning of the proceedings, the prosecution was made aware that that was the theory of the case. That's a very important distinction. So really, the facts were not different. Secondarily, and really important as well, is Mr. Noonan was never convicted of felony child neglect, second-degree felony murder by child neglect. So obviously, there isn't that same prejudice like we have in this particular case. And third, and also, Mr. Noonan, the issue in the case was whether or not the instruction was proper, not whether or not there was proper or sufficient notice presented to the defense. So while I think this panel could find under Noonan, what difference does it make, Mr. Reed, who cares? The fact of the matter is Noonan's is very distinguishable. And we really don't have any assurances from this jury as to what facts it formulated the second degree felony murder. The other important part of that argument, if I may, justices, is this. The way in which it came about. When we were settling jury instructions, the defense raised the issue of getting involuntary manslaughter as an instruction and as a corresponding verdict form. It was Judge Herndon's position that when we asked for that, that it then implicated the felony murder by child neglect, second degree felony murder by child neglect. That is simply not the law. And so in doing so, in doing what Judge Herndon felt was correct, he then allowed the verdict and the instruction to go forward without any actual amending of the information. Prosecution mentions, and there's a discussion on both sides about amending the information. When can that be done? I think pretty much at any time. I'm sure certainly by the conclusion of the trial, we should probably have the evidence sufficiently pled. But that was never the issue in this case. There was never a motion that came from the prosecution to amend the information to plead an alternative second-degree felony murder by child neglect. It just never happened. And so that is where the problem lies in that particular issue. And unless the justices have questions, is there a particular issue that the court wants to address? Otherwise, I'll keep going into another area.
How about the statements?
Okay. In terms of the suppression statements, Justice Cherry, it's our position that when you look at all the factors in the case, that this was custodial interrogation. And as typical in homicide cases where they don't read Miranda, they contact the alleged and say, hey, do you mind coming down here? Come on up to the police station. We'll chat. And they get the chat, and then they either arrest or don't arrest them at the end of the interview. What we have here is significantly different, justices. We have a situation where Cody Gettings is the only suspect that is agreed upon by everyone. Cody Gettings is sought out by the police. There is a number of armed police with cars and the lights blazing show up, find Mr. Gettings, point their guns at him, say, get down on your knees. They search him. They remove everything from his pockets. They handcuff him. They put him in the cop car, and they drive him to the police station. Now, this is where the particular officer was not sure as to when the handcuffs were removed. But I submit to the court, does it really matter? What would a reasonable person think? If you just know those facts, justices, what does a reasonable person think at that time about their status? Handcuffed, searched, back to the police car, driving to the police station. We know when Cody begins the interview, he is unhandcuffed. We know at the very beginning of the interview, he is told, oh, you're free to leave. Keeping in mind, he was just handcuffed. He is in a small room with no windows, with homicide detectives there with their guns and their badges. He never leaves the room. He's never given the opportunity to walk around. And he's arrested at the end of the interview. So we have all of those facts that steer towards there being circumstantial evidence of
counsel, even if those facts would cause this panel to reverse the determination by the district court judge as to the custody status of your client. wouldn't there still be a harmless error analysis on the Miranda violation?
Yes. The answer is...
And what is your view of that analysis, assuming the court also concluded that the statement was nevertheless voluntary?
That the court should find that it is not harmless error. And the reasons tie into... I'm sorry, Justice, I was trying to get to that. The reasons tie into what we know from the way the case was charged and from the decision that was made by the court. Excuse me, by the jury. It's obvious that the jury did not find this to be abuse. But it is also obvious that that statement... if you remove it, the prosecution has very little evidence as to how the jury would ever have convicted of second-degree murder by child neglect, because they had the lies and the inconsistencies that they presented to the jury. They had Mr. Getting's statement about the tank falling, which I guess apparently the jury found to be the neglect. So it can't be harmless, because without that evidence, there is not a single witness that can show the theory that we guess that the jury convicted on.
Well, don't the experts offer testimony? I know there's one that's kind of in conflict, that the retinal hemorrhaging was a product of a shaken baby syndrome.
There's some evidence of that, Your Honor, but when you look at...
Just some evidence. You've got two or three experts saying that.
I do.
I recognize
that that's out there.
Not, but.
It's out there, but what we know the alleged, and what the theory was that it was abuse, not shaking, and was striking the head, and that the fracture was the primary source of the injury.
Mm-hmm.
So the shaking was only a component of the actual skull fracture, you know, the damage to the back of the head. It wasn't some independent. Believe me, I'm sure a skilled prosecutor like Mr. Stoddard would have put it in the charge. So while that fact is out there, it clearly could not have been something that was beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, you have 3 minutes left. Do you want to preserve that time for rebuttal?
If justice is allowed.
Does anybody have any questions of Mr. Reed at this point? All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Stoddard.
May it please the court. Thank you, justices and counsel. I'll try to address some of the issues. I know the briefing's been done, and justices have read the briefing. With regard to the notice issue, I think Noonan is very clear on this issue, and at least I've not seen any decision post-Noonan that even impinges on that sort of theory that the state is not required. Initially, we pled open murder in this particular case. At trial, the state adopted or decided to proceed only on, at least at trial, and filed and amended accordingly, that we would only proceed on child abuse as the mechanism for felony murder in this particular case. It was only when, and under the state's actual vehement objection, because we did not believe that there had been any evidence really that had been brought forth before the court, before the jury, to indicate that there was some sort of accidental type injury in this particular case, that the issue of involuntary manslaughter came up. Now, under Graham, once involuntary manslaughter is allowed to come before the jury, the murder related to that, if the jury does not find involuntary manslaughter, is second-degree murder. So we are obligated under Graham, I think it's reversible error not to include the second-degree murder instruction. And this came to instruction at the end and what theories would have to happen based on that. Now, the issue with regard to the second-degree murder by child neglect was second-degree felony murder, which has been narrowed clearly by this court to specific circumstances, and I would submit that this was one of those cases where it narrowed to the very specific circumstance which would be allowed in this particular case. But by virtue of the fact that the defendant proffering at least a story that was, whether you believed it or not, was clearly neglectful, at the very best case scenario for him, if everything had happened exactly the way he had envisioned it and told the detectives at the time and proffered to the court, or not to the court, but to the jury, that if he had believed that, he would be guilty of child neglect and a death resulting from the child neglect. So it didn't prejudice him in any way that there was any issue with regard to the notice or the charging. He was on notice of it because he brought forth the neglectful acts himself that would have supported that. With regard to whether or not we have to amend when somebody raises that, I don't see any support in the case law that would suggest that we have to, during jury instructions, to then amend charges to add additional elements, or not additional elements, but factual averments, which would support the new or the other things that are going to come before the jury in the jury instructions. I think that Noonan goes to that very issue. In fact, Noonan says in that particular case, there were no factual averments that led to a decision or a discussion of neglect, but it said, the decision said that the information was essentially okay because it did not allege second degree of felony murder or any negligent actions by the defendant. So the fact that there was no amendment, that there were no new allegations of neglect, was essentially deemed by this court to be sufficient notice under the statute to allow for us to charge, and not to charge, but to at least present and proffer to the jury that this was, at best, a second-degree murder by child neglect, and at worst, for what the state perceived was, first-degree murder by child abuse. With regard to the issue of the statements, I believe that I know that that's certainly something that would be concerning to the court, that somehow or another there was some sort of pressure placed on the defendant to come down to the station to do things like that. We have to go back and parse out what actually happened. Now, and what the police and what the defendant actually knew at the time all of this went down. Counsel mentioned that he was the only suspect. He was not the only suspect at that point. We had two individuals who were involved with the child, one who brought the child to the hospital with an explanation which ultimately had come from the defendant, but she proffers that explanation to the medical people, and she is the one, the only one with the child at the time. They know that she, based on what she said, that she's with this other individual, the defendant. So now the detectives, the police, are looking at two potential people. They want to talk with the other individual who was supposedly present. At the time that he is contacted by police, that's the information that they have as far as two people involved, injuries that are so catastrophic. And these are not little shaken baby type injuries. That's a component, certainly. But there was a large stellate right-sided fracture extending over the side of the skull. The actual bleeding within the brain was so significant that it pushed the entire brain over to the other side of the skull with no injury to the other side of the skull itself, but within the brain. And when they did the surgery and incised the dura, a clot expressed from that incision and shot 4 feet across the room in the operating room suite, which showed the incredible pressure that was inside that head at the time that the child presented to the hospital for the surgery, which was the second hospital based on the fact of the delay in the treatment that had occurred and the false information that had been provided. Now, the issue with regards to the statements, when he stopped, the police don't have any of that information initially. They know that the child is in the hospital, is in trouble, they have some information about him being present, but when they go to stop him, it's by phone call. He's not stopped on the street initially. He's contacted by telephone. He agrees to meet with the detectives. He picks the place where they're going to meet. When they do meet, patrol officers are the ones that first respond, and because they know that this is involving the death and he's potentially a suspect, they do put him in handcuffs at the time. They do have a felony-type stop. Within a 10-minute window, however, and this
felony
is...
Felony-type stop? I mean, this is about as extreme as it gets.
I would
surrounded
I would
by
the
cop cars. I mean, it sounded like they were going after a terrorist here as opposed to someone who was just trying to arrange a meeting to be interviewed.
Well, I would agree with the court that at least the fact that guns are involved, police officers are involved, he's essentially put in handcuffs at the time. He had also a person that he was with at the time who said the very same thing. He was put in handcuffs. They didn't know what the situation was.
As I understand it, the record isn't entirely clear whether he was in handcuffs when he went in the unmarked car, the detective's car, to the station or not.
It is. That I would dispute. And here's where this comes in.
Where is the evidence that shows that he was not in handcuffs when he was placed in the vehicle?
Detective Seacats, who takes him to the actual station, mm-hmm. states that he places him in. He first arrives on scene within 10 minutes of the stop. He asks immediately for a key, a handcuff key. He takes them out of handcuffs. That's his testimony, corroborated by the fact that the person that Mr. Gettings was with was removed, his handcuffs were removed at that time. So he says that he takes the handcuff key, removes the handcuffs from the individuals. There's a conversation at that point with the detectives down at the Detective Bureau in Henderson. He, the defendant, agrees at that point to go down to the Detective Bureau to ask or to answer questions down there. At that point, he's placed in the front seat of an unmarked patrol car with no barrier between the front and the back seat. He's placed in handcuffs. He buckles his own seatbelt, despite the fact that during the evidentiary hearing, he testified otherwise. But the detective would not have put him in the front seat of the car if he had been in handcuffs. That's one thing that came out. He remembered taking him out of the handcuffs. He didn't know exactly when it had happened before the transport took place. But his testimony was that he arrived at the station, not in handcuffs. When Detective Abernathy meets him at the station, meaning the defendant, he is not in handcuffs. When he goes back to the room, he is not in handcuffs. There's no handcuffs sitting on the table at any time during the interview. And I've watched that video as recently as this morning again, to address maybe some of the concerns that this court may have, that neither of the detectives in the interview room are wearing weapons at any time. They sit in the interview room specifically not in front of the door so that he has at least a clear shot at leaving the room. On the table immediately next to him are all of his possessions. They didn't keep anything from him. All of his possessions are right there through the entirety of the interview, and at the very close of the interview, he actually even asked the detectives if they would take that stuff and go out and give it to his mother, because his mother and his friend had driven down with him to the station at the time. He's told at the outset of the interview that he is not under arrest, that he's free to leave at any time. They actually reiterate that down the road. During the interview, Detective Robbins again says, "Would I have told you that you were free to leave if we thought this?" At that point, where he physically is in relation to his house is about a five-minute walk away. If his parents or his mother and his friend had not been there and he had decided to leave, it wouldn't have been as though he needed to be transported anyplace. He could have easily walked down there. And I know that there was some discussion about this in the pleadings and some gloss over it, but I think one of the things that the judge felt was important, too, was the fact that there was at least some indication that he had some knowledge of law enforcement and how things work. He had actually been questioned by police at that very detective bureau related to his own child abuse case and had been told he was free to leave and had been let go at the end of that interview. And that was within a few months of this actual time period. So he had at least experience and knowledge that was very close in time to the events in question that showed that he, in fact, was free to leave. He was never, even the detectives, when they testified, they were asked questions about this issue, said that up until the point that he changes his story and starts making this disclosure about something that actually happened to the child, which now really causes a problem for the detectives, if he had said at any point that he wanted to leave and terminate the interview, he could have walked out the door. He was not under arrest. They did not have enough information at that moment. Now, clearly things changed down the road with getting phone records and talking to other people and actually finding out what had actually happened to the child. A lot of those things happened post-events. The police...
I thought that Jamie provided to the detectives her recantation of her original statement before Geddes met with police. I thought that she informed the detectives that Geddes had told her to make up this story about the circumstances involving the child's injury. Didn't all of that take place before Geddes was contacted?
I will tell you this.
Isn't it true that...
I don't know.
I've asked you several questions, and I apologize for that, but... Maybe the greater statement is, what, in your view, did Jamie tell the detectives before Geddes was contacted in the parking lot?
The actual timing of the information in that regard, I cannot, without reviewing it again, tell the court exactly, because it's a very short window of time.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you that in reviewing the statement made by by Geddes during the interview and the questions asked by the detectives during the interview, I do not recall them confronting him with the fact that Jamie told us that you told us
I'm not suggesting that.
So if
but it certainly has a lot to do with assessing the prong about whether he was a suspect.
Well, there's no question that he was a suspect.
Even more than a suspect. I mean,
but
he was the target.
He was a person of focus. I'm not even debating that. He clearly was a focus of the investigation, one of them, but he wasn't the only one at that point. Now, he is a focus. He is at the police station. He is with police. And those are all things that work against this.
Assuming for the moment that the court concluded that he was in custody and that he was entitled to be Mirandized under the circumstances. Your brief didn't talk much or at all about whether or not a Miranda violation would result in harmless error analysis, and I wondered if you could share that view or discuss that with me.
I would. It did not address that. I would agree with the court. The fact that
we do read what you write.
I'm sorry?
We do read what you write.
I know, Your Honor. I didn't mean to indicate otherwise. With regard to whether or not there's harmless error, I would submit that it is harmless error.
So what would you point to?
Here's what I would point to.
What would be the analysis if the court were to write an order on this matter, finding he was in custody and a Miranda violation, but it was harmless?
The fact that he raises this sort of accident or neglect issue as at least an explanation as to why things happened, mm-hmm. or what happened with this child. Clearly, the injuries and the fact that he was alone with the child for an hour when this catastrophic injury takes place, with no explanation at all, I think he likely, if he'd gone to trial with no statement by him at all, I would submit to this court that I think it would be highly likely that he would be found guilty of first-degree murder by child abuse. And here is why. Because there would be, unless he would come forth at trial and proffer that same statement, the same explanation, which means that it would come in and be before the jury anyway, and therefore it would be harmless if it comes in, that unless he proffers that sort of explanation, which is the only explanation he proffers in the case, that the jury would have been left with nothing more than huge catastrophic injuries, a limited window of time when he was the only person caring for the child, with no explanation. I think it would have been near...
Go ahead, finish.
To his detriment, that he would not have been able to proffer that explanation or any other explanation. I think that the reason that he proffers that explanation to the detectives is that he knows, in talking to them, that this is a really serious problem with this child. She just didn't get better. He knows what he did. He knows, but he's hoping that it will get better. When he finds out that this kid is going to die and not get better, he's got to come up with something. I would submit to you that the reason it would be harmless is because he would have had to have proffered something at some time under Miranda or not, and if he did not, that at trial he would have been faced with a much more severe penalty potentially. And
are you shifting the burden on him?
No, not at all. I'm just asking what the outcome would have been, Your Honor, based on the fact that if we just had excluded, and I think that's what the court was asking, if we'd excluded that explanation. Not that he would have been required to do anything whatsoever, but if we believe that he did not come forward at trial.
But in your statements in response to Justice Hardesty's question, you're asserting that he had to do certain things to refute what you were putting forward. So you are putting the burden on him now that he has to make these statements. I use the word has to, not should, but has to. It's a difference.
May I respond to that?
Yes, please.
I believe that there's a distinction there. It was something I was saying that I would believe if I were in his position or somebody like him was in his position. It is not incumbent upon him to do that whatsoever. I believe that if the statement had been suppressed and there was no alternative statement made by him, no indication that he had to, that we would have gone to trial with the evidence that we had, which would not have included anything related to an acetylene bottle falling or anything like that, but simply him being with the child, catastrophic injuries that are clearly a result of abusive head trauma, and no explanation, he would have been in a very bad situation, I think, at trial under those circumstances.
So the only mention... Mr. Mead argues... I'm sorry, go ahead and finish and answer your question. Answer Justice Ogle's question.
So the only reason that I've raised the other issue is that that would have been an alternative. Clearly, he's not required to do so, but it would seem as though when faced with the ultimate potential penalty of what he was looking at, that he may have offered it, may not have offered it. If he did, then it would be clearly harmless error because it would have come before the court or before the jury anyway. If it didn't, he would have been in a far worse situation. So I don't think that it's harmful error if it was error at all. And I would not submit that I would agree that it was error in the first place or that it was involuntary or that it was a non-custodial or a custodial interrogation.
Could you comment on Mr. Reed's observation to the same question that this harmless error analysis is connected to the notice problem that he talked about in his opening argument, that is that the confusion that apparently existed with the jury question and the amendment issue that you all talked about in the trial is impacted by this harmless error analysis as opposed to or as comparing neglect versus abuse? Would you not have been required if this was if this statement wasn't there to have chosen between the two and asserted that in the information?
No. And here's the reason why. We know the state was very careful in argument. The state was careful in pleading on that regard with regard to two distinct issues, two distinct acts in this particular case. The first one being the abuse of the act as proffered by the state or a neglectful act as proffered by the jury in their findings that led to the injury that the child sustained, which by all intents and purposes was going to cause that child's death regardless of what took place thereafter. I don't think there was any evidence brought forth from any of the medical people that that was probably a survivable event. The fact that post-event, the actions that or inactions that take place, which prolong medical treatment for this child, and we know the child was not fully unconscious. The mother arrives home 38 minutes after the call to her from the defendant. He's 2 minutes away from the hospital. He could have called 911. He could have taken the child. He doesn't. He waits 38 minutes for that child, that mother to get home. When the mother gets home, the child is posturing, she's calling to her child, the child's raising her arms in response. She's clearly in very grave trouble and in clear pain, according to the mother. The fact that this child had to endure all of that for all of that period of time and not gotten medical attention with an explanation as to what took place so that they could intervene in a timely fashion and reduce the pressure on the brain, which could have saved brain tissue and certainly pain for this child, is indicative and supportive of the second charge. And therefore, I think that regardless of the issue of the neglect or the notice related to that, we still would have had the two counts. We still would have had the secondary act because that evidence would have come in. Because we had somebody who testified to that. We had the phone records to support it. We had all of those things that show that there was essentially a delay in treatment. So I don't think that there's an issue of notice of neglect, and the jury's question was, gosh, do we look upon these as separate acts, or do we look upon them as one single act? And I submit that they are separate acts.
Thank you for your argument morning. Mr. Reed, we'll add 2 minutes to your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Ron.
Let me start with the suppression, if I could. To answer Justice Hardesty's question, you're correct, Your Honor. The way it went down was the mother of the child had talked to the police. She's at the hospital, and she had originally said she was there, but very quickly recanted. She recants prior to homicide then attempting to contact Mr. Gettings to take his interview. So he is the only suspect. And if you don't take my word for it, Detective Seacats testified at the evidentiary hearing that Cody Gettings was the only suspect. There's no mention of mom as being a suspect at the evidentiary hearing.
Did they mention why they would not have advised this fellow of his rights?
He's not in custody.
Is that the answer? They didn't try to explain it at all?
No.
Not in custody?
No. No, they just merely were taking advantage of the fact that he got out of those handcuffs at some point and told him initially he's free to leave. And on that note, too, Justices, keep in mind that it's pretty passive in terms of how he says, hey, you know, you're free to leave. Besides the obvious, I'm just walking out of the Henderson police station. We've all been to these to these police stations. You're just not walking out of there. There's badges and everything. There's surveillance cameras. There's locked doors. I go in to look at a file. I can't get out of there without an escort. I'm not walking out of there. But anyway.
Well, that's certainly understandable. Maybe they want to keep you there, Mr.
If they're going to try and extract a confession out of me, I'm asking for a lawyer. But the context of this, Justice, is at the end he says, this is the detective that's interviewing, says, if I thought you did something intentionally, I wouldn't let you go. Words to that effect. It's on 2682 of the actual appellate record. And the reason why I say that that's so important is because it shows the state of mind of the very detective that took the statement, that obviously they're being very passive about this. You know, you're free to go. That's no problem.
It is true that Mr. Gettings' previous experience with law enforcement, he was told that and did.
Yeah, he did. That's true.
So, and that is a factor one can take into consideration, at least with respect to the voluntariness of the statement.
Yes, I agree, Justice. I think that kind of covers the
question.
I
have a question for you, if I may shift gears.
Yes, sir.
The prosecution made reference in opening statement and a couple of other times through at least the detective testified, about your client's attempt to reach a lawyer.
Yes.
My understanding of the record, but I want to be clear about this, is that in every instance in which this occurred, an objection was lodged by defense counsel and the court sustained the objection. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
Then I can clarify. At the actual trial, there was evidence of it that came out about him contacting the lawyer, and that was let in, but not with the context of it was a lawyer, just the person's name, if that helps clarify. But again, we objected.
Well, I'm just trying to determine whether or not there was some abridgment of one's Sixth Amendment right by commenting on their wanting to contact an attorney. There was objections made, and they were sustained to references to counsel.
Yes, and they didn't come right out and say, he called a lawyer, so that's consciousness of guilt, but it was definitely implied. And I would analogize this to the Romay case, which is a published case in which...
How was it implied? Again, we're dealing with the cold record here, and what I could tell in comparing that assertion of error, it looked like every instance the objection was sustained, so I was trying to determine what would be the basis for the court concluding that error happened when the court has rejected that basis.
Because a typical juror, I would think, would perceive contacting the attorney and us objecting, because we had no choice, basically to try to cover up the fact that he called the lawyer, as he has something to hide. You know, and that's how we got into the colloquy with counsel, too, about whether he has to testify or not testify, same kind of thing.
But we do respect the jury instruction that says they'll follow the instructions, and the instructions of the court include what is kept out.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Was there any other final thought you wanted to offer, Mr. Reed, or any questions by my colleagues in the case? All right. Go ahead, sir.
Since I just had a minute, if the court will indulge me, I wanted to comment on a couple things about the suppression.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the court's been at this diligently. It's also on whether he's free to leave or not leave. Keep in mind, the head of CCATS said that Cody Gettings, was not free to leave on that issue. It was a two-hour-long interview, and he was called a murderer, an animal, and a monster. So we also have to look at the nature of the questioning, and this was not some passive questioning. They had really went after Mr. Gettings. And with that, Your Honors, unless the court has questions, I'm prepared to submit it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Reed. And who's your associate here today?
This is Shauna Bachman. She was my co-counsel at trial.
Ms. Bachman, welcome. Might as well put that on the record, too, eh? Thank you for your arguments. We appreciate that. And the briefing, counsel.
Thank you.